Hey, welcome everybody to the Guild call. Sean's computer went into wacko mode, so which I'm not sure exactly what that is, but it means he's not on the Zoom call yet. So I got a couple announcements, and there is a question submitted ahead of time.
One second, Tim, I'm going to stop you there. Your microphone is also in wacko mode.
Yeah. All right.
The other way was working really well. There's gremlins in the system.
Is that better?
That's better. Sound good to everyone? Thumbs up? Yeah? Okay, good. Right. Awesome. Right. Please continue.
So a couple things. First off, if you haven't yet looked at the Hero's Journey fantasy seminar that we're doing in a few weeks, that is up at storygrid.com/hero. And I've gotten to see and hear a lot of the content that Sean's going to go over on our weekly calls. He tends to tell me everything he's working on, and it's going to be really, really good. And so if you haven't looked at that or signed up, originally we were going to do a live event. It's still live if you would like to come. And then we're also streaming it so you can attend virtually as well. And we have a professional video team coming in to make sure that all of that is going to work correctly for everybody. So I'm really excited about that. But more information on that is at storygrid.com/hero. And of course, as a guild member, you get 20% off that. Also, we're getting close to the end of August. So we are 8 months into our first year of the guild, and Sean and I have already made some plans of what we're going to be doing in 2021. We've got some really fun stuff that we're working on, some new additions to how we're doing things, a new product we're going to offer that you'll get when you sign up. It's really cool. Can't wait to share it with you. That will probably be early November when we start opening that up, but we'll let you know more about that. I'm going to go ahead and just answer one of the questions that was submitted ahead of time. Then when Sean comes on, he'll do his training and we'll get into the questions. So Mike asked, I'm curious to hear how Tim and Sean thought the launch of the CNC went. Did the strategy to give out ARC's advanced reader copies for free pay off? Any big lessons learned or things that went better than they anticipated? Any info they'd be willing to share in regards to how the business side of things is going would be interesting to hear. It's interesting because right now the book for next month, for September, for the Guild is going to be the second edition of my book, Your First 1,000 Copies. And I rewrote the whole thing from start to finish. So it's been interesting to go back through, this is something I wrote it the first draft 8 years ago. And so going back through all of this content after 8 years, having continued to do the work and teach it, and now from the StoryGrid side of things, running a publishing house, it's been really interesting to think through the marketing side some more. And playing this role is interesting because usually when I would work with an author to launch their book, it was this defined kind of space where, you know, I'd get hired 6 months, 9 months before the book comes out. I would work about a month past the book coming out, and then I was done and I moved on with my life. And getting to be a part of a book like The CNC that we did such a big push behind, the author's continuing to do a big push, but I get to continue to work with it and see how we're doing marketing long term has been really fulfilling and interesting and fun. And also, so many times the publishing house's goals and interests are in direct competition with the author's goals and interests with most traditional publishing houses. So with StoryGrid, they're much more aligned, which is really good. But as far as how it went, I've been really happy with the sales. Not a day goes by that we don't sell copies of the book. It sold a lot of hardcover copies of the book. The author, Mike, is doing a good job continuing to promote the book. He's been on several different podcast interviews. He even arranged a bulk buy where somebody in his network bought 200 copies of the book, sent us a spreadsheet with all the addresses. And so we shipped out all of those books and we got to, you know, put an individual like flyer in each one. So that was really good. As far as the giving away books, this is probably going to be how we do it from now on. You know, Sean originally published a blog post on Stephen Pressfield's website years ago about the 10,000 reader rule and how the goal is to get 10,000 people to give your book a try. And I look at the picture in my head for that as the idea of like a rocket ship taking off, where you have to get 10,000 people to give it a try. And if you stop at like 3,000 people, it'll always crash back to Earth, right? If the rocket just turns off its engines a third of the way up, every time it's going to crash back to Earth. But you have to give it enough push to get it out of the atmosphere, and then you have to kind of see if it's going to fly on its own. So at this point, we've exposed the book to probably about 5,000 people altogether. And so we're still in those early stages. But what was really neat for us was, and for me as somebody that's been doing marketing for a long time, is that we as the publisher, you know, Mike didn't have, he's well connected in some areas, but he has no platform of his own. He has no major social media following, no email list, no blog, none of that. And so we were able to bring him his first, you know, 2,500, 3,000 readers as the publishing house, which as far as I know, there is no publishing house that does that for their books. So that was really good. And to see the book get so many good reviews, we're at like, I think we're at 259 reviews on Amazon, a few hundred reviews and ratings on Goodreads, see so many reviews, and then to see those natural sales coming in. So again, you know, we're getting sales every single day of the book. So I think it was a win. I honestly wish we had done this for the threshing back in February. If we had had the idea back then, I think the threshing would be selling better because we would have gotten it more out into the world. But this is probably going to be our plan of how we're going to promote all of our books in the future is, you know, month to 2 months before it comes out, get it out into as many people. You know, I can't remember who said it first, is that it's easier to, maybe Sean said it, I can't remember. It's easier to sell a copy of a book than to get somebody to read it. And when you talk about a book like The Sand Sea, you know, that's almost 800 pages long, you know, sometimes I would pay you $35 to not make me read a book like this. And so getting people to actually read the book and leave reviews was a really, really good move. And so I've been really happy with it. The publishing house in general, it's, you know, I've never done this before, so I never know, like, are we doing good? Are we not doing good? But, you know, we're every month money is coming in from all the different book outlets and people are buying books directly from us on the website. And, there's, you know, Sean said a couple of weeks ago that this is how Black Irish started, where at first it's just trickling in and then it just slowly builds over time. So I've been really happy with it. Pleasantly surprised how smooth everything has gone with publishing. I mean, we're going to publish 18 books this year, which is just insanity. Everything's gone relatively smooth. So I've been really happy with how we put CNC out into the world. I think looking back, I wouldn't do it any differently. And again, it's going to become the blueprint of how we put books out from now on. So is Sean with us yet? Okay. Oh, he is. I see a Sean coin.
Hang on, I'm looking for him. Oh, look, there he is. I guess we'll
allow him to join.
Yeah, seeing who he is now. All right, Sean, I believe you can unmute when you're ready.
Oh. Whoops. Okay, great. Okay, can everybody hear me? Thumbs up? Okay, great. So, yeah, maybe later I can tag on to that question, but I think it's better for me to get into sort of the meat of what I want to present today, which is thematically about conventions and obligatory moments, which is this month's book. Instead of getting into the details, you can all read the book. I want to give, I need to share my screen. Let's see, screen share. Great. Let's see. Am I still there? Yeah. Okay. Let me pull up the PowerPoint here. Maybe. Here we go. And slideshow from current slide. Okay. Basically, what I want to cover today is the big macro picture of where, you know, did I just make this stuff up about conventions and obligatory scenes or obligatory moments? Or is this baked into some sort of larger macro system that we can use when we get confused about why do I have to have this convention anyway? What is this obligatory moment about? So generally today, I want to go over in very broad strokes the origin stories of conventions and obligatory moments. And no one will be surprised when I pull up this slide, which is called evolution. So it's my contention that story is follows the same sort of systemic dynamic complexity as our best theory about the natural world, which is evolution. So evolution is, it's really about natural selection, and it has a whole bunch of components to it. So I'm gonna walk through this very quickly, and then I'll get into the second component, which is metaphysics. So evolution deals with the dynamic complexity of natural life, right? It's all about the physical matter of living things, how we adapt to our environments. So I'm just gonna start up here with this sort of box here, which is called, I call it the top-down selective constraints. So selection is all about what the environment is presenting to you at one specific time and place. So evolution is incredible because it's an anti-fragile system. Whatever the environment brings, evolution allows for adaptation, right? And so the constraints, what constrains the system is the sensibility of the environment. Is it cold? Is it hot? Is it sand? Is there enough to eat? All that sort of stuff, right? So that's a constraint on who can survive in the system. So if you're a brown bunny in the Arctic, you're probably not gonna survive very long because you'll be identified as food and you'll be eaten pretty quickly by a polar bear. But if you're a brown bunny in a forest, you're gonna have what they call an adaptive advantage, right? So what is constraining the system is the nature of the environment, right? So the thing that's really cool about evolution is that what Darwin figured out is there is no one specific trait that makes any one species more adaptive than any other, right? So the actual constraining system is the environment. And when the environment changes, it selects for a different kind of characteristic. So this is awesome because what it allows for is unpredictability, right? It allows for random events to happen and for the system to respond in such a way that organisms can adapt themselves or be adaptive to the constraining of the system. So there's another kind of constraint that's called a selective constraint. So the tundra has a certain selective constraint on the kind of species that are going to be able to survive inside of it. And so it's selecting for a particular kind of characterization. Now that's a selective constraint. So that binds the site. So down here, what we have is bottom-up enabling constraints. And what enabling constraints are, the ability of the natural world to survive in moments of environmental change. And the way natural selection works is that there's all kinds of species, right? There's all kinds of animals, all kinds of bacteria, all kinds of stuff, and it's constantly, new creations are evolving all the time. So when the environment changes, there's going to be certain species that are going to be able to live in that environment. And so that is the bottom-up enabling of life to continue. The variety of species adapts to the environment. It's an amazing system and it's anti-fragile. So what that means is that if all of your species can only survive in a certain kind of environment and the environment changes, bang, they all die. But what variety does with the different kinds of individual characterizations of each individual of the species is that some of those individuals are going to have a mutation that's going to make them survive in an environmental challenge. Okay, so these are the two big forces, like constraint and opening up, right? So we're constrained, the environment is pinching, and then the bottom up is pushing against it, right? We're getting more stuff while we're being constrained. And with that, we get evolution. And it's awesome. And that's what brought together Homo sapiens 200,000 years ago. It's amazing. All right. So down here, what you've got here in the center is the magical thing that happened 200,000 years ago. It's called autopoiesis. And autopoiesis is basically, all it means is the ability to self-create, self-repair, and self-terminate. So we as an organism have all of these qualities, and so do dogs, and so do cats, and so do bacteria. So when two parts of our DNA come together, when we're a zygote, we start to grow. We self-grow, right? It's amazing. We don't really know what does this, right? This is the big existential question of religion. This is what religions are trying to figure out. What is this thing, this autopoiesis? Who gave us that autopoiesis? And from the way I think about it, I don't even really worry about it, right? It's just a fact. We are able to self-create, self-repair, and self-terminate, which is an amazing thing. So each of us, our cells have a certain number of ways that they can multiply. It's called the Half-Life multiplication limit. So our cells can only multiply like 45 times, and then we slowly degrade in senescence and we terminate. And that is the autopoiesis process. So isn't that kind of cool? You've got a beginning, the self-creation process. You've got a middle, which is about self-repair so that you can adapt to your environment and survive. And then you've got the end. You know, we're all gonna die someday, right? That's self-termination and it's all built in within our cells. So this is evolution. This is the way it works for every living thing. It's amazing. So I'm just going to quickly go through the rest of this stuff. Basically, this autopoiesis process started 200,000 years ago for us, way, way longer than that. Life on Earth is about 700 million years old. And in that process, what happened is there were a binary system came about. There were XX and XY. So these two DNA representations enabled to have a baby. And so they split half of their chromosomes and then a baby event, you know, that's the causal event of creation, mate selection and reproduction, right? This is how we self-generate the species. And then we have a baby and then the baby goes through a trinity of growth and maturation, a trinity process that I'm not going to get into, but it's really cool. And this trinity process brings us back to parents again. So you see how this spiraling is really cool, right? Because what we have is this is the first generation, the second generation, the third generation, and this is the way Homo sapiens has evolved over X number of generations. So generally, this is all you really need to know about evolution, that there are constraints of the system that constrain it. There are enabling constraints that actually allow for adaptation within that environmental constraint. And then over here, we have what are called adaptive affordance. And all that means is that it allows for relationships to come together, right? The parents here, that's a relational affordance. And, you know, who knows what attracts people to one another, but whatever that thing is, that affords this, all right? So this kind of chemistry of two people coming together and deciding to have children is the affordance that generates the species. It's awesome. Okay, so that's evolution in however long I just talked. Let's now see if we can map storytelling to evolution, because I think, here we go, I think story is the complex dynamic system of metaphysical force. So just as evolution has facts, you know, associated with it, like XY and XX chromosomes and all that stuff, story is about truth. It's about deep mythic truth. So the heroic journey is my estimation. Now, I don't call it Campbell's heroic journey, hero's journey, and I don't call it Jung's individuation process. I've got a new thing that I call the heroic journey 2.0, which is kind of an integration of Jung, Campbell, and cognitive science. So I don't want to get too much into this. I mean, I'll be talking forever about it shortly. But generally, this is the mythic anti-fragile engine that constrains the individual and the collective species as a means to generate wisdom. And what wisdom does for us are deep truths that enable us to survive, thrive, and derive meaning of our lives. This is what gives us meaning. Wisdom generation is what perpetuates the species. And it stops us as a species from self-terminating, right? Because we as individuals can do all this self-creation, self-repair, and self-termination. But guess what? When you extend that up to a group, they can do the same thing. So in my estimation, the heroic journey 2.0 is the message in the bottle from our ancestors that teaches us how to cultivate wisdom so that we don't self-terminate as a species. So when we lose the thread of the heroic journey and we don't understand what this stuff is all about, we get way, way, way off track as a species, as individuals first, and then collectively as a species. And it's my theory right now, this is the big problem we're all facing in our culture right now, is that we don't have this mythic truth anymore. And so because we are disconnected from the heroic journey 2.0, we are having difficulty deriving meaning from our everyday lives. And because we are having difficulty deriving meaning, we're getting way off course and we're falling into really bad disinformational systems that are misdirecting our agency. So we're worried about things that are tangential to the big problem. And what is the big problem? It's keeping the species alive. And how do we do that? We have to realize that we're all in this together, that we're all connected. There's no such thing as the us and them. We're all them. Anyway, so story is the way to deeply connect to this fundamental truth. And just as evolution has all these constraints and affordances, so do stories. So let me go back to this top-down situation, and we'll talk about this in terms of the constraints in the story, right? So the collective constraints are the content genres, right? These are the need-based acquisition development systems that we use to be able to navigate through the world. So if I want to write a story, I want to think about my genre, because what that's going to do is it's going to limit my search space on how to solve my problems, right? If I'm writing a mystery story, I'm not going to have to worry about society at large as a meta content genre. I'm just going to worry about my red herrings. I'm going to worry about a really good puzzle. I'm going to really focus, constrain my stuff so that I don't fly off the handle and start trying and worrying about things that really aren't important for my mystery story. So the selective constraint for story is primarily genre. Genre choices constrain your problem-solving arena really, really well. They're extraordinary tools, okay? So the great thing about genre, too, is that it's a complicatedly ordered system, meaning that once you learn the toolbox, once you learn the form of your particular genre, then you can really play around and be able to create something new and fresh. So the other thing that constrains us are masterworks, right? So masterworks within a particular genre help us because they are really terrific examples of stories that worked, stories that transcended the creator's lifetime. So what, for whatever reason, those masterworks, I believe, have embedded Heroic Journey 2.0 within them. All right, I'm not going to get into that too much. But let's just go down here. So basically, the selective constraints are genre choices, right? So in the book that Kim Kessler and Leslie Watts wrote, they talk about genre very specifically. And they talk about the obligatory moments, the constraints that that genre puts on the story that give you the form of the story. So they're giving you the formal shape of the way these stories are constructed as the selective constraint. All right, so let's, okay, so that's constraining the story, that's going top down, and then the bottom up process is enabling, it's opening up, right? So the opening up system in story is each one of you. This is the variation element. Each one of you is capable of telling a story that none of the other of us can, right? So each person has the capability, their own voice, their own story that they can relate and bring a brand new specificity to this massive series of problems that we're trying to solve, which are what genre is all about, solving a hierarchy of needs. I don't know why that went out. Okay, hold on. Okay. There we go. Okay, so I did it again. Okay, everything technologically has gone wrong for me today, and now it's continuing to do that. All right, so I'm not going to touch the screen any longer beyond that. Here we go. So the bottom up, I'm going to do one quick analogy to explain top down versus bottom up thinking. There is a system now, I think I've mentioned this before, it's called Quibi, which was this new startup started by Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's an old Hollywood professional. And he decided that he was going to build a system that delivered 6 minutes of content that would be easily consumable by people. And he would bring together the biggest stars and the biggest clients from Hollywood. And he would tell these long form stories in 6 minute bits, 6 minute pieces. That's a top down process. So he has this idea and then he jams his idea and he collects people to create and execute his idea. And then he puts his idea in these 6 minute bits out. So that's a top down process. Now, the example of a bottom up process is TikTok. TikTok is just the system that enables individuals to create their own content however they want to. And it's 30 seconds. And it doesn't tell you what you have to do, how you have to do it. It just says you've got 30 seconds to do your thing. Now, guess which one is really working extraordinarily well today? And which one isn't? It's TikTok. And Jeffrey Katzenberg's system isn't working very well. So when we're using top-down thinking, we don't want to get too much in love with our deep intellectual thinking and our jamming down the throats of our consumer exactly what we want them to have. Instead, we want to explore scene by scene with this bottom-up sort of allowing yourself to tell your own specific story. So that's just a quick aside. The bottom-up processing is about micro detail, and the top-down is about macro, you know, rule-based stuff. Now, what are the obligatory moments? Where does that all fit in? The obligatory moments come from the selective constraints, and they're genre-specific. That's why we put out the Beat book on obligatory moments, right? Because those obligatory moments are consistent pattern recognition across a specific genre over time. So by examining multiple examples of masterworks within a specific genre, I was able to put together this list, this laundry list of patterns that were present in masterworks across the genre. And then Leslie and Kim put together this and they blew it out. You know, they brought their individualness to the project and then they made it better. Okay, so that's what the obligatory moment system is. And down here, this adaptive affordance, these are story conventions, right? So the story conventions afford relationships. So they're the affordance mechanism that enables the story to evolve. So if you're telling a love story and you never have the two lovers meet, that convention and that obligatory moment affords the relationship to come together, right? So the convention of a love story is that you have two lovers or multiple lovers, but you can't just have one lover, right? Because that's boring. Nobody wants to hear about how somebody loves themselves all the time. So the affordance is the convention of having at least two lovers present in the story. So that's what conventions are. They afford relationships between the players in the story. So obligatory moments are the selective constraints, patterns that repeat themselves in specific genres. And the conventions are the affordances that enable the actual delivery of those obligatory moments. I think it was Kim who said that the conventions are sort of like nouns and the obligatory moments are verbs. I think that's a really cool way of looking at it. So if you don't have people in relationship, there's no verbal action. There's no action that can result. So the conventions give you the setting system of players that will enact the obligatory moments. So when you look at conventions and obligatory moments and you go, this seems like bullshit. It seems like these are just rules that Sean came up with off the top of his head and I don't really want to buy into it. You can certainly have that attitude. But what I'm saying is that I'm supporting the notion of conventions and obligatory moments by mapping the global system of storytelling onto the global naturalistic system of evolution. So it makes sense to me that the way things work in our physical environment, evolution, are the same systems at play in our metaphysical environment. That's called exaptation. So exaptation is when you adapt one tool and use it for something else. So the first thing that happened in life was we physically adapted to the environment before we became cognitively conscious, right? The birth of the mind emerged from physicality. So, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, the chicken came first, but I don't want to get into that. But the mind emerged from the body. So using and exacting the body systems that make it capable of adapting into its environment for the mind only makes sense to me. And there's thousands and thousands of examples of exaptation, not only in the physical matter arena, but also in the metaphysical psychological arena to back me up. So all this is to say is that I think it's a pretty good heuristic that conventions and obligatory moments are really something to pay attention to. And to understand when you're kind of not sure why they're there, sure, question it. And then you can always trace it back to this, you know, complex dynamic system of story and say, well, which part of that is you know, fits inside of this big integral landscape. So I know that's very wonky and abstract, but I did want to address, it's really important to me that people understand that this isn't like my theory, I'm making this up off the top of my head. These are all principles that are founded within empirical the empirical natural world. So we can rely upon the story grid methodology, you know, in totem. Yeah, there's problems within it and we're trying to fix them all the time and refresh them. But I think it's a very, very powerful tool to be able to figure out what's wrong with your story and how to fix it. Okay, I think I should stop there. We've got about 25 more minutes and then I can answer questions from last week.
So did you hear the question I was answering when you came on about how we feel the publishing and promotion, or mainly the promotion of the CNC went, specifically giving away the ARC copies, and then overall how it's going with the publishing house? Did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that just like every other institution in the natural world right now, like we're seeing sort of a fragmenting of our political systems. It's a very disturbing thing to see everything so polarized, right? And so we're seeing a fragmenting of that, and also to have two candidates who are on closer to self-termination than self-repair and self-creation, that's a little disturbing to me. But all right, so the political situation's a little weird, no matter what place you sit on that spectrum. And the educational system's weird, right? No, we're not really sure what's going on there. The economic system's weird, right? So embedded within the economic system is the book publishing business. So the book publishing business is in this very strange place too. And it's transitioning from an older paradigm into a newer paradigm that is still sort of it's emerging, right? So we're in the presence of a book publishing emergent system. So the way I'm looking at, and the way Tim and I sort of designed StoryGrid Publishing, was to go closer to that bottom-up sort of TikTok-y sensibility, as opposed to the top-down, we know what's best for everybody, and we're the gatekeepers of literary quality, right? So God knows, I am not infallible. I make mistakes. There are, I can list thousands of mistakes that I made, and I can list a lot of mistakes that I made in terms of commercial publishing, right? So recognizing that you're not an infallible source, and what you want to do is sort of build up the TikTok-y nature of book publishing and really salute that and enable it, right? You don't want to constrain it. You want to enable it. But when you do constrain it, you want to constrain it with a metric that you really think is important, right? So the metric that all book publishing has traditionally used to evaluate story is financial performance. So if a book performs well, then it worked. If it doesn't perform well, then it didn't work. Now, StoryGrid is completely different. So we needed to create a publishing house that could have a different metric. And our metric is the StoryGrid, right? So our StoryGrid is all about trying to create works that are in keeping with the masterworks, right? So we have these masterworks that we all love and adore, and we want to analyze them and find the pattern recognition of the things that all of those masterworks have in common. And then we want to look through that lens when we're looking at our own work, and we can figure out ways to change it so that they're more in line, closer to masterworks than not, right? So that's our metric. Our metric is, we're going to give it everything we have. There's going to be come a moment when it's time to ship. We're going to ship with honor, with dignity. We're going to say, this is the best we've done right now, and we're continuing to move forward. That's our strategy. So We believe that strategy is embracing of creative people, and that creative people who like to work hard and are interested in story are going to be attracted to that ethos. So it's difficult for all of us to sort of transition from the old metric of, I've got a New York Times bestseller, therefore I'm successful. We have to sort of like take that and put it aside, right? Very difficult to do because we've all been programmed with that language for a long time. So what the story grid is about is, I busted my ass. The people that I admire and I think are really smart, they've approved of my work. Together, we've put together a book. We've put it out there. We've shared it with our community. And our goal is to get 10,000 people to give it a try. That's our metric. And so that comes from 30 years of experience in book publishing, knowing that, you know, as William Goldman said, at bottom, nobody really knows, you know, what is going to work in the culture at any specific time. But what we do know is what we love. And what we love are the masterworks. So why don't we model our behavior on the structure and form of the masterworks so that our work can get a little bit better. All right, so how did the Sand Sea do? I think it did incredibly. It has 259 reviews. And all we said was, read this 800-page book for free and give us an honest review. And 3,000 people downloaded the ARC, maybe more. That's just my off the top of my head. I don't really follow the metric. But I know it was multiple thousands of people did that. And 259 of them were motivated enough to write a review. That's amazing, considering the fact that New York Times bestseller like Stephen Pressfield, his last novel, has about 32 reviews. So for me, what that says is I don't really worry so much about how many two-star reviews and how many four-star. That really isn't so important to me. What's important to me is that even people who give it two stars, they were energized, right? They were saying, this isn't up to my standards. And I'll tell you what, we love that kind of passion. So the fact that we're motivating people to actually engage in stories and to think about them at a deeper level is a super duper win for me. I mean, that's all that there is really. Now commercially, yeah, we have some metrics that we're shooting for. It's not really about sales, it's about exposures. So yeah, we're as a publisher, I maintain it's the publisher's job to do what they have to do to get 10,000 exposures for a work. Then the work is on its own, right? We love it. It's sort of like you raise your child, they're 18, it's time, you know, goodbye, here you go, here's a knapsack full of some lunch, but get the hell out of the house now. It's now time for you to find your own way. That's the way we have to look at our work. They're our babies, we love them, we adore them, we put all of our life and soul into them, but there comes a time when we gotta push them out of the freaking house and say, you're on your own. And you know, sometimes things work out well and sometimes they're problematic. That's okay. But we've got other babies we have to bear. We have got other things we've got to put out into the world. So we can't let whatever the market says define us as people. All we can define ourselves as are explorers of the story universe, busting our ass, doing the best we can, and helping our other fellow explorers. So for me, I couldn't be happier with the Sand Sea. I love the cover. It was a great creative process for everyone. And, you know, I talked to Mike on Saturday, and guess what we talked about for 3 hours? We didn't talk about the Sand Sea. We talked about the next book. And that's what we're trying to do here at StoryGrid. We're going to do our best. We're going to get it out there. We're going to support it. And then it's on its own.
All right. This one's from Anne. I often get going writing about my characters and then after 20 or 30 pages realize I've left out several characters entirely that are central to my plot. How do I get more characters operating in my arena more consistently? How do I make sure I don't leave people out entirely?
Well, that doesn't seem like much of a problem to me. And I'll tell you why, and I'm not trying to make fun of you. I think what you're experiencing is a flow state. And what happens when we get into flow, when we're just starting out, is that we don't recognize that we're in a flow state. And so we think it's a little weird that we're just flying and these words are coming and we're avoiding certain characters and our story is progressing in a way that we never thought. And, oh, geez, I really need to top down this, stop that flow state and jam in some other characters so that I can, you know, keep on track. And what I say is that you're experiencing a flow state, just run with it, because we spend 99.9% of our time in the left hemisphere of our brain. And the left hemisphere of our brain is super important. It's incredible. It's what puts food in our stomachs. It what puts, you know, clothes on our back, gives us a roof. I love it. But it's more top-down processing than bottom-up processing. And top-down processing has a tendency to be tyrannical. And so what tyranny is a strict rule, a strict ideology, and you are never, ever, ever to not, you know, abide by that rule. So when you are writing and it's flowing, you have actually moved the center of your consciousness and your attention from the left side of your brain to the right side of your brain. And what the right side of your brain is built for is storytelling. It's what creates meaning. It's the thing that perceives, that sees the relevance of patterns and makes connections in the brain. So when you're writing in the flow state, you are doing that and you're doing it, you know, magically. So my advice is just spit out as many words as you can in whatever character is talking to you. And when you hit the wall, because it costs a lot of glucose to operate in the right side of your brain. This is, it's just proven. So the right side of your brain burns a lot of energy. And so what happens is your blood only has so much glucose running through it at any specific time. And once you start depleting that blood glucose level from your brain, you start to get exhausted and then you snap out of the flow state and you either have to go get something to eat. And it's usually, for me, it's around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I start working around 5:30 or 6, and then I'm done. I'm toast. And I have lunch in there to get more energy, but then I'm done. So don't sweat it is my answer. And just make notes to yourself. Oh, want to put Jim into scene 9 and Sally into scene 12. Just write that down when it occurs to you, and then it'll go away. And then you can keep writing. Because there nobody is there with a stopwatch. These aren't, you know, this isn't like a sprint situation. So this is what all the Toolbox of Story Grid does for you, right? The Story Grid micro spreadsheet is going to tell you when you have to dump more characters into a scene. So just get a draft, then spreadsheet it, and then that'll give you all the answers like, oh, I need to do X scene where blah, blah, blah happens, and I have to put it in between scene 6 and scene 7. And that's, Story Grid methodology is very left brain centric, but it's about analyzing the product of the right brain. Hope that helps.
Okay. So how does Story Grid structure apply to series? In a trilogy, for example, how far would the first volume go into the middle build? And where would the middle volume stop in the overall story arc? Would longer series break the overall arc into smaller parts, or do some parts of the arc need to be contained within a single volume?
If you're contemplating writing a series, I always say, you know, just burn everything, burn every bridge, Don't hold anything back on that first book. A series is about the evolution of an individual. It's Jungian individuation. So if I were tasked to, somebody said, put me in a cage, and they said, okay, you've got to map out 5 seasons of a Netflix television series. Each season has to be 12 episodes, and it has to follow a single character. Go. Well, the first thing I would do after I threw up and wanted to kill myself, the first thing I would do after that, it would say, well, if somebody were to ask me what makes a person, how does that work? Let me think. I would go back to self-creation, self-repair, self-termination. And I would say to myself, how is this person going to integrate the very difficult nature of their psychic phenomena? And what that means is, in our minds, we have sort of it's called brain 1.0. And brain 1.0 is your limbic system. And your limbic system just operates on emotions. It's a brilliant system, and it's indispensable for our survival. If we don't have the limbic system, we don't know that there's some weirdo walking behind us in the middle of the night. And we don't know to get the hell out of there, right? So our limbic system is incredible. All right, so that's the first system, but it's also all about short-term thinking. So your limbic system operates on pain and pleasure. So we want to avoid pain and always increase pleasure. That's what our limbic system is all about, right? Because think about it. When there wasn't much food around and there was some food, that brought us pleasure when we were, you know, our ancestors. So we got to gorge. We got to fill up because that is what we need to survive. Okay. So pain and pleasure are the principles by which the limbic system operates. So I would say to myself, I want to take my character from someone who operates purely from his or her limbic system. That might be book one. And that book one is going to get them to learn, holy shit, always using my limbic system isn't so good. I don't feel good. I don't feel good about myself. All I'm doing is X, Y, and Z. So that would be the transitional moment of book one. How that person learns that to just live for pleasure is a fool's errand, because it doesn't give you a coherence of self inside of you, right? So I would think like, well, season one is about someone who's living purely from their limbic system. And at the end of season one, they're going to have a worldview shift. And they're going to move from what's good for me is good for me and screw everybody else. And they're going to move from that to, maybe taking other people into account might be a good idea. That might make me feel better about myself. Something as globally abstract as that would give me a frame to be able to bang out a beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff using that worldview framing. So basically what I'm saying is, and then the second series would be about leveling up that cognitive framing from short-term thinking to medium-term thinking. And then globally at the end, the last, you know, 12 episodes would be about how that character has reconciled their spirit with the natural world. How can they transcend themselves? The way they would transcend themselves is by leaving some sort of meaning behind, right? And the way you leave meaning behind is through your creations or your destructions, right? So if you destroy a tyranny, you're the, you know, you're the rebel alliance that, you know, took down the bad guys. If you're a creator, you've created the Mona Lisa, right? So creation and destruction, there are this yin-yang opponent processing that is very, very helpful when you're thinking about the trajectory of the cognitive development of your characters. But instead of thinking about, you know, the keys to the nuclear codes as, you know, framing devices for a series, I think it's more beneficial to think about how is my character going through the process that we all go through, where we try to find some coherence of our mind and body and spirit. That's cool. That would be interesting. So when you're thinking of these big, big epic series of novels, bring it down to how is my character going to move in this arena from unenlightened to enlightened? And then like, oh, I've got it all figured out. Oh shit, I don't. Then the second series is unenlightened to enlightened. And you can see like these steps. It's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Maybe your first season is all about action. Maybe your second season is all about saving. Maybe your third season is all about love, right? Use the tools of the story grid to figure out how to frame the trajectory of your micro scenes. So that's the way I would approach it. And as you can tell, when you're thinking about the big masterwork, the big, you know, 45-hour incredible miniseries, Game of Thrones. I mean, George R.R. Martin's been thinking about this since he started writing. That's why he doesn't want to finish, by the way. He doesn't want to finish that last book. Would you? I wouldn't. So that's my advice. Think big, big abstract stuff, all about the mind, about the integration of the mind, the body, and the spirit.
Right. Here's a question from John. Can the five C's overlap? If you have a sequence which is playing out over multiple scenes, is it possible to layer in another sequence with its own five C's in between?
Sure. That's Pulp Fiction. It's constantly cross-cutting between sequences with multiple character points of view. So Pulp Fiction is a good thing to look at because you'll see it switches from, and it goes through, and it switches time too. So the beauty of that construction is that it's like Balzac's novel, the comedy humaine, which is all about how the repetitive behavior of human beings is so ridiculous that it's a comedy. Right? We just repeat the same crap over and over and over again. So I think that's part of what Tarantino was getting at, is that the time signature for the Pulp Fiction, what he's saying is like time makes no difference. This is the human comedy. This is shit that people, these are the dramas we create. These are the things, the life and death circumstances that give us awareness. They're salient, they're interesting. And so Pulp Fiction is all about salience. It's all about getting your attention. And that's what the movie's about. That's what Pulp Fiction was about. It was like the first kind of pornography. It was salience for salience sake. And it, what does it do? It goes right to your limbic system, right? So we've all heard about how you know, the social networks and all those things, the way they work is they hijack your limbic system. So we all have a limbic system. We can't get rid of it. And we're all looking for our pleasure and we want to reduce our pain. And so what the social networks and the virtual realities do and the video games do is they hijack our limbic system so that we're constantly getting these little micro bits of neurotransmitter dopamine with the new clickbait tagline, lose 5 pounds in 6 hours. Shit, right? Oh, I want that. And then you click it and then you find another one. And before you know it, it's hijacked X number of hours out of your day. And to what purpose? It goes back to that metric I was talking about earlier. When your only metric is financial performance, you're not aware of what's really important. I'll make that crazy statement right now. If all you care about is money, you'll never find any meaning in life. Because it's true. Because money is actually an abstract metaphysical construct. As you know, I don't want to be Foucauldian or Derrida here, but it's true. You know, it's a power base that uses money as the means to manipulate us, to keep us from actualizing and transcending ourselves. Because guess what? They're threatened by that. Anyway, sorry.
It's from Scott. During the discussion with Michael McClellan, who wrote the CNC, he drew a distinction between the art and architecture of writing. Do you anticipate StoryGrid in the future addressing the art of writing? And also, do you think the style of writing should change to match the genre?
Well, I'm not so interested in dictating style. And the reason why is that through personal experience, what things are not stylistically interesting to me are very stylistically interesting to other people. So I do not understand, care for, or whatever, the music or the books that my kids talk about. And I just, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I can't believe they like that shit. Oh my God. But they're not using proper language, you know? And so that is what stops me from that, because I fear we selectively constrain the system too much when we really tell people how they're allowed to talk. And when we start dictating speech and writing, that is the beginning of a disaster. Because when you do that, now it doesn't, you cannot define good style from bad style. Because guess what? Sometimes good style is bad and sometimes bad style is good. Bad style, right? Now, would we have Hamilton if someone said, hey man, you can't use hip hop stuff to do a Broadway musical? That's not the style that we like on Broadway. And guess what? That was true for X number of years until it wasn't true. And that guy took hip hop style. He took whatever poetic pentameter it was that is goes all the way back to Gil Scott Heron in the 1960s. He took that structure, that style, and he created an emergent thing that was so much better than the sum of its parts that we all sit there in awe when we experience it. And everything, you know, when you watch that, if you ever get the opportunity of seeing it live, but even the movie was fantastic. You just sort of like, you sit there and then all of a sudden it's over and it's 2.5 hours and you're like, your jaw's on the ground and you go, how was that possible? So that style comes from an evolution. It comes from a change of different people's perspectives. The variation of style is what gives spice to life. I would never ever say these things I hold concretely true and all stylists must abide this structure, because I think that is horrific. Because what does it do? It puts a real clamp down on that thing, that bottom up, right? The enabling of individual variation is what creates our adaptive ability to deal with the changes in our environment. So when the environment shifts, what do artists do? When they see a tyranny, when they see injustice, do they say, wah, wah, it's like that famous thing, like Martin Luther King didn't have a plan. He had a fucking dream, right? He had a dream, not a plan. What's the dream? He's thinking of what could be. Let's join together and let's go there. He's not saying all people must do this. All people must do this. Everybody has to turn over their driver's key, you know, their keys to their car, and we're going to have a lottery system, and whoever, he doesn't have rules like that, because you can't do that, because then you destroy variation. And then when everybody's the same, we all die. Because guess what? The environment changes. If we're all the same, we can't adapt to the change, and it wipes out the species. So I am not going to ever tell people how to create their style, because their style is only theirs. And whether I like it or not, it's theirs. I want to encourage people to develop their style by cognitively growing, by understanding the story of the structure of story, because story is the only thing that can save us. So no, we're not going to do any style books.
couple more here real quick. Does Story Grid Publishing send advanced reader copies to the standard trade journals, library journal, etc. for reviews before publication?
No, because that's just that's a closed loop of excitement, as they say. When I say a closed loop, the only people who read those reviews are people who write those reviews, and the only people who write those reviews are people who review those, right? So it's a closed loop of an old paradigm that has nothing to do with people who care about reading. It's a system that used to work when there was a broadcast system, when there were bookstores that only were able to stock X number of copies. So the way that worked was that it was a scarcity model. So the only way to get your book into a bookstore was by playing the game and feeding the system that would broadcast that your book is worthy of being bought by Library Journal or Booklist or Kirkus or Publishers Weekly or what have you, right? So there are these systems that are coupled to an economic system that is completely dissolving, right? It's fragmenting. So we don't play that game because that game is dying. And I don't really care if Booklist gives the Sansi a 4-star review or a 5-star review. And what we're trying to tell people when they come to Story Grid is you've got to take that third party validation shit and put it away, because I'm not going to spend any time or effort having lunch with the editor in chief of Publishers Weekly so that they do an interview with you, because it is meaningless. It only funnels back into people who don't care about you anyway. Sorry. So no, we don't send out ARCs.
Yeah, and I can say from experience working with the authors that have gotten like Kirkus-starred reviews and those kinds of things, they have zero impact on actual sales of books.
Even Wall Street Journal. Steve's last novel got rave from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Didn't sell one single extra copy. Because nobody trusts anybody anymore telling you that something's good from a newspaper. The only trust that any of us have is in our friend or our brother or sister who says, you know what, this is going to be awesome. You should read this. That's the only thing that's going to get us to even go near that 800-page monster. It's not going to be Kirkus or Wall Street Journal. Who gives a shit?
Well, and even a friend of Mike's that has 3.7 million followers on Twitter put up a glowing review of the book, and I could trace it to about 30 sales.
That's a lot, actually.
Yeah. So do the yeah. Anyway, I won't get into the marketing. All right, we'll end with this one. What masterwork do you look at behind the Sansi? Like if,
when you're talking about epic fantasy fiction, you've got a handful of candidates here, right? you're looking at Lord of the Rings, you're looking at the Earthsea, Ursula Le Guin stuff. The thing about the epic fantasy novel that is primary is the heroic journey. Because if you look at the evolution of storytelling, the epic fantasy novel sort of came online. It's sort of a combination of people like H. Rider Haggard or whatever, you know, the guy, King Solomon's Mines, you know, those big Victorian adventure novels, which were very much colonialization. There were power stories about our great, you know, our great culture bringing it to the savages kind of stories. Like they don't hang together very well today, because we can kind of see the worldview behind the storytelling in such a way that it's distasteful. So anyway, so those kind of met with the like the Peter Pan kind of novels, which came out of sort of children-esques and the fables, the Grimm's fairy tales. So the fantastical reality of alternate thinking and alternate universes melded with these epic adventure novels in such a way that it gave rise to The Hobbit. And, you know, like everybody knows, Tolkien was a scholar, and he believed, you know, he was a linguistics master. He created his own languages. He was deeply ensconced in myth. And his goal was to actually create the myth for, you know, England. And so what did he do? He looked at the myths of the really, you know, the great myths from Egypt and Mesopotamia, the Cyrus and Osiris myths and all those things. And also the, you know, the Viking myths, all that stuff. So anyway, this all came together in the 1900s, which is very interesting, right? Because at the beginning of the 1900s, we had the Russian Revolution. We've got World War I. The entire world is bathing in about 25 inches of blood. And nobody knows what the hell is going on. Does this sound familiar? Anyway, so nobody knows what the hell is going on, because, as Nietzsche said, the importance of this sort of religion as a guiding principle for secular society has gone down, right? So that's what happened. And so Tolkien was like, man, this is a mess. He fought in World War I. He saw the mess firsthand. And deep down, he's like, we've got to bring back this myth. Because guess what? This myth is important. These people took the time while they're trying to survive facing tigers and lions and no food. And they took the time to write these messages down for us. We need to bring these messages back, because they can be our salvation. So he wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings as a direct means to imbue us with a deep sense of mythic truth. Myth is not bullshit. It's truth that has been handed up to us from the smartest people on the planet, who were able to survive so well that they were able to write down stories for us. So he said, I want to rescue the past that's being destroyed by Nietzsche's Death of God, and I want to put it into something that won't offend anyone, right? Because the minute you start talking about religion, people freak out. I believe in this, and I believe in this, and that person is wrong, and I'm right, right? So you got it. I mean, this is the great thing about storytelling, is that it can push away all of that crap, and it can get to the heart of the matter and talk about pixies and fairies and this stuff, and people are like, oh, it's this cute little book about pixies and fairies. No, it's not. It's about how we cultivate wisdom. It's about how we're going to cohere as an individual. It's about how we're going to cohere as a species. It's about how we're going to survive environmental changes that we can't predict. We cannot predict what's going to happen tomorrow. You're never going to be able to predict it. It's impossible to predict it. Don't listen to anyone who says that there's some singularity, a prediction. It's a lie. What the myth is truth. There are two sides to everything, right? So this is so important that it as you can see, it just emboldens me and gives me so much passion, because we all need to be reminded of this. So fantasy stories right now that imbue themselves with these deep mythic truths, we've got to throw away the way that we think that we think and come up with something new, or we're going to self-terminate. We can self-create, we can self-repair. Let's use that ability so that we don't self-terminate. And that's the message in every heroic journey story. This is the way to go about it, assholes. Sorry. This is the way to make it through the world such that you will find meaning, you will have a legacy for your children, you will die complete. You will die feeling, hey man, I gave it everything I had. God bless everybody who stays back here, but I did everything I could. That's what the heroic journey is. It's for us to seize our genius inside of us and stop being driven around by our limbic system. That's not what we're here for. We're not here to collect treasure and sit on top of it like Smaug. That's what Tolkien was talking about. You're a freaking dragon if you just sit on your treasure. You don't share it. That's why we love these stories, because they're deeply true and they make us cry. They bring us to catharsis. And we go, man, that was good. Wow. That feeling is epic truth that our ancestors died to give us. And it's our jobs to imbue our stories with that epic truth so that when someone reads our story, they go, holy shit, that's true. Oh my God, I've got to get off my ass. They don't know that's what you said because you've entertained them. Anyway, so I don't even remember what the question was, but that's where the heroic journey came from. That's where fantasy fiction came from. And that's where Mike and I, I'm going to try and find this. We taped about 2.5 days of me editing Mike's novel in the last round. I'm going to see if I can dig up that footage, because it's probably will bore you to tears, but it will show you how I approached getting Mike to embrace this. You know, Steve says it, you know, the artist's journey is a heroic journey, folks. You are heroic. You have guts. You know this is what you're supposed to do. That's why you're on this call listening to a madman shouting into a Zoom call. You know, you can't help it. It's too late. You know it. Cool. You're heroic. Now what you do is you say to yourself, hey, I want to write a masterwork. What are the masterworks going to do for me? They're going to teach me how to imbue my story with this epic truth. And the more people who attune to the epic truth, that the only metric that matters is cultivating wisdom, keeping the species alive, doing better, having justice, keeping people together, not ripping them apart and burning down each other's houses. What the hell is that? That's ridiculous. It's not a plan, it's a way, it's a dream. And that's why it's so powerful. And that's why our ancestors imbued their stories with this stuff so that we could have a catharsis and say, oh my gosh, that is so true. Huh, imagine a pixie teaching me something like that. You know, like the pixie is a fake, you know, it's a little thing so that they don't have to talk about fill in your religious leader of your choice, you know? So, okay, that's it. I know, shut up. But as you can tell, I'm getting primed and pumped for Heroic Journey 2.0 in a couple of weeks. So hold on to your hats.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Sean. I think we got through all the questions. As always, if you have any questions about what's going on in the Guild, you can see that in your dashboard, the Guild dashboard, when you log into your account on StoryGrid. To find out more about the Hero's Journey course, that's, again, at storygrid.com/hero. Thanks, everybody, for being here, and we will see you next time. Thanks,
everybody.
Bye.